He's a world-renowned zombie scholar, professor of zombies and popular media, and co-author of the book Zombie Mania, one of the first exhaustive guides to zombie cinema. He's Dr. Arnold T. Blumberg, the Doctor of the Dead.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Well, hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 98 of Doctor of the Dead. That episode 100 is coming down on us pretty hard. We're going to have a little bit of a gap between episodes because Natalie and I are heading to the Long Island Doctor Who convention coming up in just a few days and bringing our entire ATB publishing stock with us. And although a lot of that might not be entirely relevant to people that listen to this podcast who are just zombie fans, if you're a Doctor Who or Star Trek fans, obviously we have a lot to offer with the books we've been publishing. So we'll skip about a week and then catch up on Z Nation and some other things then, but I just wanted to mention that right from the start. But this episode, we're going to be talking about the latest Z Nation, which was Back from the Undead, and we're also going to talk about two films. We've been doing this quite a bit, and even though we're sort of technically out of October now, we're continuing to roll with our Halloween retro watch of a lot of mainly 21st century stuff.
I mean, to be fair, for us, it's always Halloween.
Yeah, it doesn't have to stop. That's true. No.
No.
And we're going to be talking about two that we're kind of surprised, pleasantly so, got such a response on Twitter that when we even mentioned watching them, which was the Dawn of the Dead 2004 remake. And in a past episode of this podcast, back when Scott was doing it with me, we devoted an entire episode to the original Dawn of the Dead. But we've never really spent time talking about the 2004 film, except that I've been very clear in the past how much I like it and how it's a really solid movie. And I thought even more so when we watched it again. And the 2013 film Warm Bodies, which the moment we tweeted we were watching that, just like blew up Twitter. So, but first, let's jump into Z Nation.
How are you feeling?
Actually better. Thanks to my little girl.
It's so weird.
What is loose?
My hands are all wrinkly.
In this latest episode, Back from the Undead, Z Nation delivers on something that I called, about a year ago when the whole Lucy thing was happening, and they started the usual sci-fi series trope of preternaturally aging child. I said, well, then get Sarah Coates back and play her as the adult Lucy. And lo and behold, Sarah Coates turns up again. And she really is only in a short part of the episode because the bulk of the Lucy story, unfortunately, is, at least as far as we can tell, Lucy's farewell as she ages herself to death in an attempt to save her father from the bite that he received at the last week's episode. And she keeps biting him, and every time she does, she ages.
Which I called, not the aging, but the biting.
The biting, you called that.
This is a very kind of episode when we're watching it.
These are all the things we called. And Sarah Coates takes over for, was it Tara Holt as Lucy? And I feel bad. I don't know the name of the older lady who played Lucy in like the final sequence.
Yeah, Lucy somehow developed a Southern accent as she aged into her 80s. I don't know why or how, but she did.
It's a thing that happens, I guess.
I'm assuming maybe.
Just to jump right to it, I found the entire idea of Lucy aging and dying to save him surprisingly uncomfortable and tragic to watch. And I do mean this in a negative way. Usually you say, like, I don't mean this in a negative way. I do mean this in a negative way. I felt like for a moment Z Nation had leaned too heavily in the direction of The Walking Dead, the worst tendencies of The Walking Dead. Not the violence and brutality part, but the maudlin tendency to overplay the death of a character. And then as soon as the song kicked in, I was like, wow, we're definitely in Walking Dead territory. And I didn't feel comfortable with it. But I will say, I didn't feel comfortable with it in the sense that I think they pulled it off and did it well, actually. What I mean is, I thought it was very, very sad and almost a little too overwhelmingly so from what I would expect from Z Nation.
Especially considering sort of the atmosphere and the attitude of the rest of the episode. Because for a good stretch of this episode, I think both of us had this feeling of this is sort of peak Z Nation. This is Z Nation doing what they do best. It's a bit pithy. There's a lot of off-the-cuff stuff, like the sergeant and 10K just pop outside and suddenly they're a new buddy comedy and they're shooting zombies for fun. 10K's counting again.
Yeah, 8001. We know he's counting again. So like, it felt like all's right with the world.
Doc has his little sort of talking to himself monologue where he's wandering around saying like, oh, come on, man. Why can't we ever just find like a working bakery or something?
Yeah. And even the finger part, which is truly creepy and quite literally getting under your skin creepy.
They're really getting into the body horror this season. Yes. That's all I'm saying.
But it reminded me of the scarab scene in the first Brendan Fraser mummy. Russell Hodgkinson is just knocking it out of the park with line after line. And then there was the Franken-zombie, which really felt like we were back in season one or two, where one of the real strengths of Z Nation was to take what is, after all, a very well-worn concept of the zombie apocalypse and find new and different and very often extremely fun ways of reinventing the concept. Like there's the Phyto zombie and the blasters and all these great things they did in the past, the nuclear reactor zombies. Mm-hmm. It was nice to see them do that again. And I will say, you wouldn't know this, but a lot of the design of the Franken zombie with like faces and different parts of the body and everything reminded me a lot of what otherwise I would say was one of the most embarrassingly bad modern Doctor Who monsters, the Absorbaloff. Some people know what I'm talking about.
Sorry, even just the name Absorbaloff, it yes. sounds like an off-brand like supermarket toilet paper.
It's terrible, and it's also partly based on Ian Levine, but never mind. And
why buy Charmin when you could buy Absorbaloff? Works just as well at half the price.
But I think the Franken zombie took aspects of that and also aspects of like Freddy Krueger when like he would show the souls
he
had.
Screaming. I mean, we did just watch like all every Elm Street movie. Yeah.
And I thought that was an excellent creature. And then, of course, when he grabs the gun, it was like, geez, the zombie could, you know, pull a gun.
Which is exactly what I said, because we just watched Nightmare City for the first time recently.
Yep.
And that was one of the things that really struck me watching Nightmare City of like, holy crap, the zombies are shooting guns back at them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that kind of moment in there. And I mean, the characters in this episode of Z Nation had exactly the same reaction too. Like, what do you mean he picked up a gun?
Like, yeah. And through all of this, like you're saying, we're saying it was weird, it's creepy, it was crazy, it was funny, had a great pacing to it. And then like in the last 5-10 minutes or so, it took this incredible left turn into very tragic, dark. And again, I'd like to point out, like, again, I keep saying I'm uncomfortable with it. I think they did a good job.
I mean, Keith did an amazing job acting it.
I think Keith Allen did some of his best work in this episode, seeing Murphy genuinely have the paternal instinct kick in. And then to bring Sarah Coates back, and the two of them always had great chemistry, and to have the very weird thing of her basically having to play her own daughter. And the two of them, there were two extended scenes between the two of them that I was tweeting at the time. They were beautifully done. They had a lot of dialogue to deliver, a lot of the kind of stuff that can get a little too cliched, you know, where you run through things about, I tried my best, those, you know, the kind of things that, and they did a beautiful job. They were excellent together. I just feel ultimately that the killing off of Lucy just felt like a step too far. And perhaps that is really just a good statement about it being a good choice for storytelling that I feel that way. If I didn't, you know, I wouldn't care. And part of what went wrong with The Walking Dead was it ceased to have any meaning. So maybe that's a good thing.
I mean, the other thing too is that I doubt she's coming back. However, we don't know what they're going to do in the next episode. They made a point of carrying Lucy's body out with them. It's not like they just left her behind.
Yeah, and it did end kind of abrupt. So it could be that this is a story not yet finished.
I suspect she's probably not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think this was sort of an irreversible thing that she was a bit of a fluke in the natural order of things, but also her influence is still out there in that she has bitten Murphy. She's also bitten Addie if she ever shows up again.
Yeah, where are you, Anastasia?
I mean, that's going to create quite some conflict as well. If Addie and Lucy are connected, ostensibly Addie would feel the loss of Lucy and know something is wrong.
That's a very good point. And I can only imagine when we do finally get back to Addie, obviously that'll be something they do.
Or misinterpret maybe what she thinks is the connection with Lucy as a connection with Murphy, who now also has a Lucy bite.
So there's a lot of possibilities there. I will point out, like I was saying before, Lucy as a character, in essence, was one of these very familiar sci-fi archetypes. The chosen one, the child that's born of like a bizarre set of circumstances. Quite a few times I've mentioned the comparison with Elizabeth from V. And of course, there are many other examples. But I thought it's kind of interesting, though, that in her dying to save her father, it kind of subverts the entire concept because she's not now the chosen one or the savior if, you know, she's completely out of the story. And of course, we do still have this really bizarre arc going on with Warren, who basically is taking on that role, at least in some sort of prophetic sense. Now, you came up with a concept about Warren that I thought was really brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, she obviously has been pre-programmed with something. And I've talked about it before in a previous episode of how, you know, maybe something that they were doing experimentation-wise has implanted her with these visions, but it also seems like it has implanted her with information.
She has specific like steps that are programmed in. She knows like her hand needs to move a certain way.
She knew the code to get into the locked area of the lab. Mm-hmm. She grabbed something random out of a refrigerator and injected herself. And let me tell you, when the power grid has been down for 8 years, and you find a needle in a post-apocalyptic refrigerator, I just don't understand how anyone who hasn't been pre-programmed to do so would then be like, I'm gonna just inject myself with this right in the shoulder, pass out for a minute, wake back up, get back to business.
It's all good.
So my thought at the time was, is this even Warren? Did they make some kind of Warren clone? Because we don't know what happened to her. We were just told she spent 2 years in a coma.
Right.
In that little like Ziploc bag that they had her in.
Well, I don't think they would go quite that far. We don't even know if Warren, the one that we followed the previous few seasons, is even still alive.
Correct.
Once you came up with that, it's very possible there never has been a real Warren again, that this is a replacement. But I love the, because, well, go ahead and finish, because you were saying... You obviously saw the connection with another major franchise. And
to be fair, I've had Resident Evil on the brain, it seems.
We do have to watch the final one.
We still got to get around to that. And some of the Resident Evil movies had been on cable, just marathoning before Halloween. And after last week's episode, I watched, I guess, the next to last movie. I think it was
the fifth one.
Like Revelations or...
whatever.
Some that sounds very biblical.
Afterlife, whatever it is.
Yeah. And first of all, in that Resident Evil movie, the very beginning, they're trying to interrogate Alice using a very shrill, extreme noise in order to scramble her brain and incapacitate her. And I was like, hey, wait, that sounds familiar. Mm-hmm. Now, they also had the ruse in the third Resident Evil movie, I want to say.
The third one's the one that's mostly like in the desert.
Yeah, it's the third Resident Evil movie. You see that they have created all of these clones of Alice. And they're using them as some sort of test that they keep putting them through this gauntlet of challenges. And ultimately they die at different stages and then they dump them in a big Alice pit that they have dug in the desert that they don't even bother to put dirt over top of, just a big old pit full of Alice's.
That pit, that scene could only have been improved by like a 1966 Batman era sign that just said Alice Pitt. Official Umbrella Corporation Alice Pitt.
Yeah. I just had all of this flashing through my head because I had just watched a lot of this. Also, in the one I just watched, the next to last one, essentially they'd created all these test environments where they were testing out apocalyptic scenarios using actual people. But the people they were using were all clones that they had created from about 50 like Umbrella Corporation assets that they had their DNA and they were just churning them out. Yeah. There was just a factory full of people that they were populating these cities with.
And I think we'd already noted how Warren's revival in the White Room was very much based on the Resident Evil opening anyway.
Yeah.
So maybe that was like a little clue to the possibility that Warren is not what she seems.
I mean, I just keep zeroing back in on the fact that it was all so neat.
Yeah.
And tidy and the funky shoes.
It also reminds me of the multiple Ripley clones that come up in Alien Resurrection. Only in that case, it's more about them having gone horribly awry and trying to do it. But then for all we know, they're going to play that. You know, I'll throw this in as something to possibly have called later on. Will we ever get a scene where we go back to Zona or back to something else and see the big room full of Warrens that didn't work?
I mean, they had that deep freezer full of all the blends.
Yeah, that's right. So what if they find other Warrens?
There's like some other deep freezer full of Warrens. Or I just had the most amazing...
Okay.
If you're listening and you haven't recorded the end of the season, let me just say that a Warren versus Warren battle would just be amazing, where...
They each have a Z-shield, and there'll be the bullet time slow-mo thing where they run at each other, and that'll be the cliffhanger.
And they're fighting, like, within the fire rainbow world.
Because it all comes down to the real vision that she had is the real place.
Yes.
And that'll be the cliffhanger for the season.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There you go. So, there you go. Carl, Craig, Dan, everybody involved.
Just toss us in a writing credit, and it's yours. Just take it.
Just say thanks, and we'll look forward to seeing that realized for us. Thank you. As far as anything else in this episode, I mean, like we said, it was very enjoyable. It felt very much like it recaptured a lot of the feel. And then, of course, there are some other classic things thrown in, like the "there are things man was not meant to know." We get a good old-fashioned scientist desperately trying to do something they should know better about. Like, I love the fact that when we discover that Frankenzombie was part of this other large effort to graft zombie parts onto living human tissue in an effort to benefit from the zombie's genetic strengths. And like any of us that have seen one single other zombie story would be screaming at the screen, what part of science did you think this was going to work well with?
Maybe it's like in the vein of moldy toast turns into antibiotics kind of thing.
Maybe.
Except that it's a zombie, so it's going to go wrong.
Yeah, it's going to go horribly awry. So yeah, but then that also is tied into the whole mystery of what it is exactly that she has in that canister and what's going on. So obviously there's more to be told there.
And she doesn't know what's in it. She doesn't ask him what's in it. All he says is, it's a terrible thing that's in it.
Yeah.
And you don't want to know. And then promptly asks her to go ahead and shoot him in the face.
Yep.
So that went well. The line that I really liked from him was they asked him, they're like, what happened? And he said, my knowledge exceeded my wisdom. And it's just a very nice summary of basically not just all of this, but all apocalypse movies. It's like, to a certain extent, all of them end up in a certain way having society completely break down because somebody thought that they could make society better. Unless it's like space goo, in which case
we were trying to make space goo better.
No, but we probably would.
Yeah.
If somebody was like, hey, neat space goo, I'm going to use it to make humanity better. I would be like, no. Don't touch it. Did you already touch it? Kill him, please.
Just shoot him.
Put him in the Alice pit and let's move on.
As part of the run-up to Halloween, we've been talking a lot about some movies, revisiting a lot of zombie classics, but mainly zombie classics from recent years. One of the things we did right from the beginning was decide we were going to look at a lot of things from the 2000s, but we've thrown some other things in, too. I introduced you to Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue. We watched Nightmare City. But a lot of the stuff we've been talking about hovers around the early 2000s. And this time around, we wanted to talk about two that are both wonderful in different ways. One of which I think we turned it on. The Sci-Fi Channel was just running it. And then we realized, what are we doing ourselves? We don't need commercials. And we put it on.
Yeah.
And it was the Dawn of the Dead 2004 remake, which we've never really spent a lot of time on the show in any of its incarnations talking about. It is a movie that ultimately, I would say, one of the most important things to get out of the way initially is it's a movie that suffers from having the title it has and from having been made under the plan of it being a remake of a classic zombie film. And really, that was all about, well, we got the rights to this title, let's do that. And the basic premise of, let's do a zombie movie where the survivors are holing up in a mall. Other than that, it forged its own path in many ways. It's a wonderful ensemble piece. There's some great stuff in it. In many ways, it's also responsible for reinventing many rules of zombies at that time when it came out, because it merges a few things. It also quite clearly diverges from the Romero rules. These zombies don't pay attention to anything other than humans. They don't bother animals and eat them. Romero zombies do. These are viral. The movie actually goes out of its way to specifically point out that someone who dies but was not bitten is not coming back. And of course, they run. But even with these variations, it's still an incredibly solid entry. It shows a lot of respect for and love for the genre and also the film that it came from, with a lot of nice little Easter egg nods. And it just has one of my favorite protagonists in any zombie movie. And it was a joy to revisit. In many ways, I think I enjoyed it more because I hadn't seen it. Like a lot of these, we've been talking about the same thing. I hadn't seen it in a few years, so it was nice to see it again.
I am a huge fan of this movie. In particular, the opening sequence.
Yes.
I mean, the opening sequence of this film is as close to perfection as you can get, in my opinion, with outlining an outbreak. Mm-hmm. In like 2 minutes flat.
I agree.
It's like you want that experience of how quick did this happen? You've got all your signposts. You know that she started her shift at the hospital and somebody who came in with a bite wound suddenly went to the ICU and she was confused. She comes home from the hospital and there's an emergency alert on the TV that they don't see because they're making out in the shower.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time she wakes up the next morning, that's it. Society is done.
Yep.
I mean, like, that's how quickly this spread. And it, you can see exactly each step along the way.
And I love the booming music. It's Tyler Bates who did the music, not a name I would have ordinarily thought of, so I looked it up. I love when it hits that really bombastic sound when we do, like, the full, not quite 360, more like a 180, but that big shot of the cul-de-sac they live in, and you get the big smoke in the background, and everybody going crazy. It's a wonderful shot.
Basically an overview of the suburbs having descended into chaos overnight.
Yes. And of course, I remember at the time, and I think you said too, I remember at the time, this movie had a phenomenal marketing gimmick where the USA Network ran that first 15-minute sequence, everything up to the opening credits where she crashes the car. They ran it uncut. First of all, it was bizarre because this was pre-Walking Dead television show. So the idea that they were going to show anything from a zombie movie uncut, and of course that meant showing all the blood and the little girl biting his neck and everything uncut on a commercial station, a cable station, but still commercial. That was amazing to me, and seeing that opening and them having such confidence in it and saying, like, this is what we're going to deliver. It was fantastic, and it wasn't like I wasn't going to see it anyway, but it was an impressive...
And they had every right to have that confidence in it.
Yeah.
Because that's an amazing opening.
Yeah, and we should mention also one of my favorite little Easter eggs happens during that sequence, and I was talking about it at the time, that during the opening sequence, we get her driving out of the area, and there's this overhead shot, and I mean, they've talked about it in the making of the movie, that you see a truck barrel across the street and smash into a diner, blow up, and it was meant to be a little homage to Ben's Beekman's Diner story from Night of the Living Dead. But this is also interesting because this movie sits in an interesting place in film history. It was Zack Snyder directing before he's going to direct Watchmen and, you know, move on to, well, DC movies. So it's not always an uphill thing. But there's Zack Snyder there, you know, directing this movie, and it's before 300 and all that stuff, and James Gunn writing the film, Gunn who's going to go on to Guardians of the Galaxy and everything. So there's a lot of stuff built into the DNA of this movie that's like, oh, these are people that are going to be positioned in big places later on.
And it's worth mentioning all of what they did afterwards, because essentially they're action movie guys. They're not horror movie guys.
That's right. That's right. And that's one of the things that I remember a lot of zombie fans and a lot of horror fans reacting to about this movie with negativity. They're like, they're saying, oh, this isn't a zombie movie. This is like a big budget action movie. It's like, this is what a zombie movie is in 2004. And it's an excellent one. And it still had a great deal of meaning. A lot of wonderfully thematic stuff. Great performances.
Tons of character work. work and character building, lots of one-on-one conversations and glimpses of what their lives were before and what their lives had become. It's one of the things, actually, I think it really captures the best from the original film, is that feeling of, like, what have we become, like, once they've been living in the mall for quite some time.
Yeah, and again, it's very different. I mean, there really isn't, there's practically no attempt to in any way parallel any of the storylines or characters from the original. Ving Rhames' character was named Ken after Ken Foree. That's about it. You know, and other than that, this is a very unique group of people. You know, a lot of people talk at the time about how Sarah Polley is basically the lead who starts us off in the film, was an odd choice because she was considered like sort of an indie star, and it was weird for her to do a film like this. And then there's Jake Weber, he's the one I was talking about. Jake Weber, many people might remember, is the husband on Medium for many years. He plays Michael, and he's just one of the nicest guys ever, and one of the just best main guys in a zombie movie ever. He has one of my favorite finales of any character, of him standing on the dock and saying, I'm just going to stand here a while and watch the sunrise. It's a beautiful moment that speaks volumes. And another thing is, he has what I think is one of the most meaningful scenes in the entire movie, where they push back on him. He's a guy that we discover almost immediately is just innately able to read people and manipulate them. And not in a bad way, but in a way where he can make people feel like they're making choices that he's helping them make. Like, you have the guy who's Michael Kelly is the head of security there, CJ, who starts off as clearly racist, clearly a rotten guy. Although he goes through a bit of a redemption during the movie, and you kind of like him by the end, and he's heroic.
I saw a couple of buses in the garage. We could fix them up, we could reinforce them, and then get as far from here as possible.
And then what?
Oh, I have an idea. While we're at it, why don't we swing by the marina and hop in my boat and take it for a pleasure cruise, you jackasses?
Wait a minute. That's a good idea. There's islands out in those lakes. There's not a lot of people on them.
I was kidding.
How far is the marina?
Oh, my God. You're serious?
I think it's a damn good idea. How about the rest of you? Kenneth?
Yeah, it's a good idea. We have to pick up Andy. He's part of the group.
Excuse me, not to shit on anyone's riff here, but let me just see if I grasp this concept, okay? You're suggesting that we take some fucking parking shuttles and reinforce them with some aluminum siding and then just head on over to the gun store where we watch our good friend Andy play some cowboy movie jump on the covered wagon bullshit. Then, we're going to drive across a ruined city through a welcome committee of a few hundred thousand dead cannibals, all so that we can sail off into the sunset on this fucking asshole's boat and head for some island that for all we know doesn't even exist?
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm in.
But he's trouble at the beginning. So Michael's like, you know, well, I guess you already thought about, you know, boarding the stuff up and putting the thing on the ceiling. And within a minute, he's already with him doing that. He's like, yeah, okay. Yeah, right. Because he knows how to make the other person feel like they've come up with it. And he's great at it.
And he's a very dramatic actor, too. There's a lot of weight, I guess, is the best way to put it. To everything.
There's a lot happening on his face.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, what I was saying was the thing that always gets me, one of my favorite moments, is when they push back on that a little bit. Like, he seems to naturally fall into a leadership role, but not in a pushy way. And then they're like, who the hell are you that we should listen to you? And he says, I sold televisions at Best Buy. And it's like, because he's nobody. And really, like, in the apocalypse, nobody is somebody. Everybody's important. And really, it doesn't have to be the apocalypse. We're all important. And the fact that he is this brilliant at reading people, maybe that helped him sell televisions, but he's so much better than that. But that's all he was. And I love that. It's beautiful touches in this, I think.
And there's sort of that I think that's sort of a thread that runs through as well. Like the truck driver, what's the character? Martha?
I can't remember now which one. I'm looking at the list of the cast.
Or maybe Monica.
Maybe.
Norma. Something with an sound. Essentially, the woman who's driving the truck that comes with the second group of, right. of survivors that show up there. She had, you know, gone to Fort Pastor because that's where the refugee camp was supposed to be. That didn't go well, and she picked more people up and turned around and came back around and sort of asked her, and like, you know, you picked him up, and she's like, well, I mean, I heard the distress call, I was already heading in that direction, and he just kind of turns to her and is like, you did good. That it's just about ordinary people just doing what they think is the right thing to do.
Yeah. And you also get, like, Matt Frewer is a character actor that anybody, particularly from a certain era, would remember very well. Very prolific for many years. Most people remember him best if you were around in the 80s as Max Headroom. He did tons of stuff, but including what I always thought was a great turn on Star Trek The Next Generation. He's in this for like all of 5 minutes. But he also has one of the best scenes in the movie where he's the father of Lindy Booth's character and he's quickly going. And Frewer's face always looks like he's about to die. He's just always been this skull face looking guy. And they just do a subtle thing on him and he just looks, in fact, he looks very much in a way, in a movie that otherwise doesn't bother with that too much, but he kind of looks a bit like an homage to Scott Reiniger's character, you know, zombifying a little bit.
Just sort of in a very rapid way.
Yeah, and a little bit too with the fact that Ken Forey was waiting for him to get up in the original and here Ving Rhames is waiting. That bit's a little bit like an homage thing. But that's another of my favorite lines. I actually, even just talking about it now, it occurs to me how much I love the writing in this. Like, there's also the line where he's just sitting there, Rhames is waiting to shoot him, and he just does the thing where he's like, you want every single second. And it's like, yeah, it's like he knows he's dying, knows he's going out, but we're hardwired. We want every second. And it's great stuff. Ty Burrell is, you know, a lot of people, I guess, know him now from Modern Family. And he's hysterically funny. He's a total asshole. Another great line where he says, you know, let's draw straws and the loser runs across the parking lot with a sandwich or something like that for Andy, the gun store owner. Another great touch. Take the gun store out of the mall and put it over there and you create a whole new set of dramatic situations. And yeah, everybody in it is superb. That whole relationship that Ving Rhames' character develops with Andy across the street is beautiful and makes it all the more horrifying when everything goes awry, which, you know, is going to happen in a zombie movie.
But you have to assume, going into any zombie movie, that something horrible is going to happen to someone you really like.
Yes.
Just will. Always does.
Yep.
And if you're lucky, not everyone you like will have something horrible happen to them.
I also think that some of the music gets oddly but nicely retro. Like, it's a movie that very much feels like a movie that fits in 2004. But there are moments where the music feels like we've slipped back into the 70s in a really nice way. I love the sort of warbling, mournful tone that the music takes when Ken Forey has his cameo as the evangelist, which also I will point out, for like a pandering cameo of a past film character being forced, not that he would have been forced, but being put in the position of having to repeat his famous line again, you know, a situation that could go awry in so many ways in a movie, I think it plays in this movie perfectly. In fact, I think that line winds up coming with a different angle and perhaps even more meaning because it's being spoken by a TV evangelist saying it. It's just a great touch. And, you know, there are a couple other cameos. People know, like, Scott Reiniger does turn up very briefly. Tom Savini. David Emge did not. I don't remember what the story was about him not. Galen Ross doesn't either, but there's no shock there.
But they did name the clothing store after her.
Yes, which she has complained about also and said that she didn't give permission. So, effects are great. There's a reliance on CGI, though, that at some points you did react to and say, oh, that didn't look too good.
Well, that inevitably, especially of the era, it gets into shaky cam mode for like its last epic action sequence. And I have so much trouble. I know it makes me a bit of like a fuddy-duddy, but it's like I cannot watch it. I can't watch shaky cam. Makes me feel ill. I do not like it. I don't think it adds anything to an action sequence. All it does is try to distract from a situation where your effects couldn't meet your vision.
I'd have to agree. And I also feel that it was, I don't remember 100% either. And there are probably easy answers to be found by checking behind the scenes supplementary stuff. But it is odd. And I know that this is something that was consciously done, is that weird thing where the whole film is shot a certain way. And then it's for the final sequence where they're out and the trucks, the one truck wipes out, that suddenly the film shifts to a desaturated, more digital looking, strobing, dropping the frame rate kind of thing, which they deliberately did as a aesthetic choice. And I just don't see where the value was in that. It's a weird thing where suddenly it's like, hey, let's take this big budget movie and suddenly make it look like 28 Days Later for no reason.
It's like they had a bit of an action sequence to start the movie, and then it was for the most part a drama, really. I mean, it's a character study. And then suddenly they said, oh crap, we got to get some more action into this because this was supposed to be an action movie. And they just took all of the action and crammed it right onto the end.
And by the way, you mentioned drama. We should, it's hard to be completist about any of these movies, but we should at least bring up the one of the truly bizarre, not entirely effective in terms of effects, but also one of the weirdest and darkest aspects of the movie is the zombie baby. And that whole, you know, that whole storyline, a character that in other stories would be one of the redemptive characters, the clear criminal who is trying to make a better go of his life and has the whole speech where he's like, I'm here to bring that baby into the world, except everything about that that sounds aspirational and fits in so well with a certain American ideal that you should all want to procreate and have babies and do this thing. Everything about that becomes a nightmare. He's doomed his girlfriend, who was not capable of being saved anyway, but turns her into just an object that is going to deliver this baby, and he's lost all sanity. It's really one of the creepiest and most disturbing aspects of it, in a good way. I mean, I think they do a great job with that.
Well, because before the apocalypse happened, he felt like this kid was his one shot at turning everything around, that he was going to do everything right that wasn't done with him, and like this was going to be a fresh start. Well, suddenly we're in the middle of the apocalypse, and quite frankly, there are more pressing things at hand than whether or not you get to end the cycle of poor parenting. And he can't let go of it, which just proves that he cannot end the cycle of poor parenting. He is not equipped.
No.
To be a better parent than his parents were. He can't accept that. He's just so fixated on the idea of it that the actuality of it escapes him. One of the things that I particularly enjoy about the movie is the character arc of Sarah Polley's character, of Anna. And the first time we talked about this, you were a bit skeptical, I think, of sort of my interpretation. Not skeptical in a bad way, just in a curious that I had read it in a completely different way. The feeling that I had always gotten from this is that Sarah Polley, her character Anna, was in a bit of an abusive relationship with her husband. Maybe not something that was physically abusive.
Are they married or are they just together?
I think they're married.
That's really weird that I don't remember for sure. Okay.
To be honest, I'm not entirely certain either. Yeah. I can't remember ever focusing in on like a wedding band or something like
that. That's a good point.
But let's just say husband for the sake of it. And if I'm wrong and it's boyfriend.
But it doesn't matter.
But either way, I think that he's emotionally controlling. She is, you know, talking to one of the other nurses at the start who's trying to ask if she changed her shift. And she kind of gives her this look like, have you asked him yet if you can change your shift? As if she has to ask permission to do it. But not only that, Anna's still at the hospital hours and hours and hours after her shift ended because she doesn't know how to say no to the doctor, who is also male, who keeps asking her for more paperwork, for more information, this and that about a patient. She was supposed to have left the hospital ages ago.
Right.
But she is so submissive that she won't end her shift or just pass off the file to someone else and say, can you find this information? In the same way, she gets home and the first thing she does is take off his shoes that he hasn't. The whole time he's been home, he hasn't taken his shoes off because she's the one who takes off his shoes.
That's just amazing to me to think of it that way. It's just not something I see that way. And when I see the two of them get in bed and he's like kissing her head and they're like talking about the other couple that had, like the other girl has the, I think she has a boyfriend. They look to me like they're great together. But you're getting this whole undercurrent of that may look that way, but there's something going on there.
Yeah, I mean, I got this impression of she is trying to find the best way to frame it to tell him what's going on so that he doesn't push back on her changing her shifts.
Interesting. And didn't you say also the whole idea of her escape scene with the keys is like, this is somebody who's ready to leave?
Yeah.
Like she knows where her keys are.
Her keys are on the nightstand. I mean, do you know anyone who keeps their car keys next to their bed?
That is odd.
I've never done it.
Does she come in and put them down, or is it just her?
Yeah, she comes in and puts them down. It's like most people come in, they put their keys
near the door.
Near the door, or they put them on a kitchen table. I put mine away in a purse. It's like they go right back in my bag when I come in the house.
She put them next to the bed.
She put them next to the bed. She figures out a way pretty quickly on instinct to run straight into the bathroom, lock the door.
And get out through the window.
And get out through the window. Then when she sees her zombified partner walking out the front door, she has zero moment of like a pang where it's like, oh, is this still you? Oh, no, this man. It's like.
That's true.
She's just like out. She's gone. She's like in the car driving down the street. Nope, it's over.
I'm not going to lie. I still feel when I watch the bedroom scene that I'm seeing a couple that looks like they're good together. But as I've often said a million times in classes and everywhere, it's like if you're picking up on things and can reasonably argue and justify that interpretation, it's a valid interpretation. And obviously everything you're pointing to is there and supports that interpretation. It's just it's never been one I've seen.
And for me, I think what leads to the interpretation is the rest of the arc of her character.
Right.
Because when she crashes her car and Ving Rhames says to her, like, say something, she just looks up and says, please.
That's interesting.
That she's okay. Still in this submissive position. She's on the ground. She's looking up. And it's please that she says. And she's still kind of going with the flow, except she finally hits this point where essentially the apocalypse has given her agency.
That's a very good recurring concept in a lot of these stories where the apocalypse, not only is it about like a revelation of human nature, it's also about everybody gets to be the person they want to be or can be in those circumstances. Sometimes it's not good.
It's like the difference between the beginning where...
Like Carol in Walking Dead.
The beginning where Ving Rhames' character is pointing that gun at her and she says, please. And then later they're standing on the roof and CJ is pointing a gun at her and she says, don't point that fucking gun at me. And she pushes it out of the way.
Yeah.
She's physically like, don't even, because she's hit that point already.
She's taking control.
Where she is taking control. And I think she realizes to a certain extent, I think she likes her life better in the apocalypse than she did before.
So does it also work then? We talked when we watched it about how there's a couple little bits that are trimmed out. We watched the unrated cut, by the way, which I think, like many movies, is the only way to see that movie. The theatrical cut is far inferior now in comparison. But there was like bits cut out that didn't show the full intentions of some of where they were heading with Anna and Michael. So do you feel like that also works? Like she gravitates to him. He's clearly like the nicest guy on the planet and he's no threat. And so maybe that's why there's a bit of a spark there, because he's somebody that's probably a good guy.
And he's somebody who respects who she is as she is. I think it's an amazing thing. And it's sort of, I guess maybe it's an interesting connector between this and the 1990 remake of Night of the Living Dead.
Ah, with Pat Tallman's Barbara.
Pat Tallman's Barbara has way more agency.
Sure.
than Barbie. And to a certain extent, it's also a story arc of her gaining more and more agency as that story goes on and coming into her own.
Apart from the found footage end credits thing, which I always enjoyed, but you don't like.
Can you say? I detest it.
Yeah. And not stylistically. You just don't like the idea that it basically seals the deal that they're probably not going to make it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fair. That's fine.
Let me have a little hope at the end.
That's fine. But I mean, basically, for all intents and purposes, what's the real last shot of the film is the shot before everything goes black and the credits start. And the last face we see is Sarah Polley's face, is Anna's face. And she's watching Michael kill himself. She gravitates. This guy is clearly a good guy. And yet, the movie's final scene, which, I'll be totally honest, I've always watched the movie more as Mike, focusing on Michael because I like that character. But really, it's Anna's movie. She's the one that starts the movie. She's the one that ends the movie. And I even called him the protagonist earlier, but really she is. By any literary standard, she is. So at the end, she has to sail away and watch as the one good guy puts the gun to his head and blows his brains out. Does that mean in some vaguely symbolic way, even though it's not what she would have wanted, she's better on her own? Like, even the other man who could have been someone that she would have been with, he has to die at the end because she's stronger on her own. It's like a way of clearing the way. Like, he takes himself out and she goes sailing away. Does that fit in some sense?
Or? I guess you could look at it that way. I mean, I guess I don't really quite see it that way.
Okay. There's no need for him to be eliminated then as well.
There's no need for him to be eliminated. I think that it certainly works in the way that they ended it. So it's not like I would have changed it necessarily. I mean, I still think he's a nice guy and wouldn't it be nice to have him sail off? But he doesn't, and that's okay. But I don't think he has to be eliminated. I mean, right up until the very end, she is still operating of her own accord. She's the one who jumps into the car wreck and comes back with the boat geek. She's like the only one who thought of that,
mm-hmm.
who was like, we're probably going to need this to get on the boat. So she has her agency fully at that point. If he stays, if he goes, the agency's there.
She shoots Steve exactly as Steve told her she could.
That's right.
So what's interesting about this too is after spending a lot of time talking about how we just really love this movie, the 2004 Dawn of the Dead, I think, is one of the modern classics in the same sense as Shaun of the Dead is. But it also sounds like this is a great movie to use as an example of the shift in women in the lead, which often happens in genre film. You know, all our touchstones in genre film, from Ripley to Linda Hamilton, Sarah Connor, to characters like Pat Tolman's version of Barbara in the zombie world, and now to Anna in Dawn of the Dead. And if you were to contrast her with someone like Fran in the original Dawn of the Dead, you know, worlds apart in terms of that. Although Fran was like the early beginnings, the early glimmers of a woman seeking agency, right? Because she says, mm-hmm. I want to know how to do the helicopter, I want to have a gun, but much more so in this one then.
I think so.
If we have a romantic thread in a zombie film here that goes horribly awry and doesn't end on a happy ending, then at least we'll wrap this episode up with one that does, because before we finish, we're going to talk about one more film, 2013's Warm Bodies. So while Warm Bodies may be the last thing we're going to discuss for this episode, I did want to bring up one other thing. I mean, I guess it works pretty well having just completed our discussion about Dawn of the Dead and the character of Anna. When we talked in the previous episode about Shaun of the Dead, there was something I wanted to bring up with you that we didn't get a chance to do. And I'm just going to bring it up now, which is that at the end of the movie, there's the whole thing about how we see them in at home and everything's been obviously redecorated and it's much more with Liz's touch, you know, things are neater and cleaner and he's keeping Ed in the shed and all that. Except that what always struck me was, it feels like although there's like a happy ending for Shaun and to a certain extent Ed, it always feels like this is a hellish nightmare for Liz, who early in the movie said that she's going to have to do something or she's going to wind up every night at the Winchester wondering what the hell happened. And basically the end of the movie is everything she dreaded comes true. She's stuck with Shaun. They're going to the Winchester later on. Everything about the lifestyle he wanted is happening. And I always felt like this like subtle undercurrent at the end of Shaun of the Dead was, for someone like Liz, settle. It's better if you just settle. It's better than the world ending. It's just give up. Do you get that at all, or do you think I'm seeing too much there?
I don't think you're seeing too much. I think what you're seeing is a love story that was written by men,
okay,
for men, and ultimately, just like at the end of sort of very formulaic, tropey love stories written, and I'll say for women, like in air quotes here, of, yeah, like in the traditional sense, if someone said, I'm writing a love story for a woman, and it's that very Pride and Prejudice sense where,
yes, yeah,
you know, in the end, the man who was just a total jerk to you the entire time, it turns out, looks fantastic soaking wet and is also very sensitive.
Uh-huh, right.
So this is essentially the other side of the trope, the sort of male fantasy, I guess, of the woman that he loves wants more out of life, and it's more than he is either prepared or capable of giving her. He would like to keep her in his life, and he would like to do better, but quite frankly, he just doesn't have his shit together.
Mm-hmm.
He can't even make a dinner reservation without screwing it up.
And she learns to accept that.
Yeah, he still gets the girl in the end. And to be fair, they do go through a very traumatic experience together.
Yeah. Maybe she reevaluates and realizes what she wanted is something like that, but it still feels like it serves
him. And to a certain extent, she sees that Sean is capable of taking action,
mm-hmm,
and he is capable of doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And so to a degree, you could say what she's looking for is to see that he can. And as long as she knows that he can and he will, that for most of the time, she's perfectly content to be sitting at home. I mean, obviously, she's okay, the one who has been dating that Sean for years.
Yeah.
So there's something about that lifestyle that she is still perfectly comfortable with. It's just she would like something else in addition to it. And what's to say that Sean and Liz, you know, a few weeks from that, don't go on a nice holiday?
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to the final thing then, which is Warm Bodies. We just watched this a couple days ago, and it was absolutely delightful.
And you'd never seen it before.
And I'd never seen it before. And full disclosure, there may have been times where some of you out there may have asked me about that, and I was cagey about it, because I felt that as the zombie expert, there's no reason why I shouldn't have seen Warm Bodies by now, but nope, I had not. So I finally got around to it, and I think it is absolutely brilliant. Of course, it came along at a time in 2013. It was based on a novel first, Isaac Marion's novel, but it came along at a time when we had been about 10 years down the road in this latest resurgence, and we hit this period where, as I've lectured about very often, you need to sort of domesticate the monster. It stays around so long, you can't always have it as a figure of fear. And it was around that time we started to see an exploration of things that also in my lectures I used to always say years ago would never happen, zombie romance. And the idea of taking the zombie and making it a lovable figure, but really what it is taking the idea of the we are them and they are us to its furthest extension, and saying what we're really doing is using the zombie as a metaphor for us, that we are sick, we need to be cured, we are sad, we need to be happy, and exploring many other themes. Like right from the very beginning of this movie, it instantly nails down the idea that alienation and being disconnected, the word connection and connect comes up frequently. In an era where we're all staring at smartphones and not talking to one another face to face, a zombie that stands for disconnection and alienation and an inability to find love and to connect with other human beings is a perfect use of the metaphor for the 2010s. It was also, like along with iZombie and other things, a way of taking the zombie concept and saying, let's use a zombie that becomes a version of us that we can find attractive, that we can also cure. It's also why I told you at a certain point watching the movie, that although this may sound strange, but I've often talked on the show about how like every movie needs to find its level of reality and stick to it. That at a certain point, I felt like the very notion that we are supposed to both accept the fact that they are dead and therefore reanimated corpses, and yet also accept the fact that love alone could bring them back to a living human form, steps away from reality and into the realm of fairy tale. And yet I had no problem with that, because that's what this movie is. But it's an interesting distinction I felt I had to make, that like, well, I can't buy the idea that a corpse could actually come back to life because it's found love, but that's not It doesn't need to be real. It is a very symbolic story, and yet it's handled realistically otherwise. And I loved it.
For the most part, it's handled realistically. I mean, I would say the size of the wall that they have built
that's true
around their survivors' settlement in that period of time is probably not something that could have been done with limited tools and limited electricity. And
I also feel a few years later this movie is perhaps even more relevant now that one of the main things and the symbolic ending of the entire film is that instead of building walls against other people, you should be knocking walls down and trying to...
Yeah, not just the physical walls, but the walls of communication that exist between us, that we have to connect with other people. I think it's just a phenomenal movie. The first time I saw it, I think I had no idea what to expect from it. I haven't read the book.
I have not read the book either.
And we looked up some of the book plot points, and I think we both agreed that we prefer the decisions that were made in the film as opposed to how some of the things were originally written.
Based on what I could tell of the fate of at least one character and a couple plot points, I know I'd probably, from my own sensibilities, that I enjoyed the film more. I'd still be interested in reading the book, but again, full disclosure, as somebody who isn't the quote-unquote expert, I've read plenty of it, but I often find that apart from a few things like World War Z, I just don't find that the zombie genre sits well on the printed page
and
as
what's
much
interesting
as in visual.
That one, sorry for talking
no,
over
no, no,
you.
Go ahead.
What's interesting about that one, too, is that I also love the book World War Z, and I think it was made into a horrible film.
Oh, the movie's terrible.
I mean is that both of us really enjoy the film version of zombies, and we both also happen to cite the same print book as the one we enjoy, which is also one that didn't movie well. It's like...
Although they didn't even try.
No, they did
not
try.
That's not... That movie
it's
is
true.
Not the book.
But I will say, if they tried to put the actual book of that one into a movie, I don't think that would work.
It would need to be like an HBO or a Showtime series, like an event series kind of thing.
But we digress.
But anyway, we digress. This was also at a time where Hollywood decided to be in the Nicholas Hoult business, and it seemed like he was in every other movie being made.
Why not? That young man has eyes for the movie business.
He won me over, and boy, does he have eyes. He's really something to look at.
And does a really phenomenal American accent, in my opinion.
Yes. And some people might know him as Beast from the X-Men movies.
I personally first saw him in the British first series of Skins. He plays a completely different type of character in Warm Bodies than he did in that movie.
His performance in Warm Bodies puts him up there, I feel, as one of the finest zombie character performances ever, with endearing aspects that take like some of the touches that Sherman Howard did as Bub and Day of the Dead even further, because obviously you weren't going to want to watch Sherman Howard have a romance.
Well, zombies don't get an opportunity to emote.
Right. Or like Eugene Clark in Land of the Dead. They're like, there have been touches in some of these.
But Eugene Clark's character in Land of the Dead is basically primarily driven by anger.
Yes.
That is just rage that is causing those neurons to kind of fire a bit and get him back towards human behavior.
And Nicholas Hoult's And of course, again, the other thing, too, we should cover is this is Romeo and Juliet, although they don't lean into it too heavily. They do a version of the balcony scene, which is a nice touch. But other than there being R and Julie, I also like the fact that R dresses in red, white and blue with the red jacket and the white and the jeans, which is itself also, besides the obvious American thing of making him the all-American boy. It's also a tried and true visual that goes all the way back to James Dean and Rebel Without a Cause. And then also, let's say, Michael J. Fox and Back to the Future. It's a good standard way of making your wholesome male lead in your American romance or troubled teen like Rebel Without a Cause. And basically R is a zombie without a cause, or rather he has one, really. And it's about, you know, finding connection.
And they do extend, I mean, the author, extends the whole Romeo and Juliet theme as well to all of the background characters, too. Julie's boyfriend is Perry, which is Paris. R's friend is M, who we find out is Marcus, but
Mercutio.
It ties in a way that is really subtle, and I love that about it.
And Rob Corddry, by the way, is like the MVP of the movie.
I love that man.
I always think he's hysterically funny, and I also think his performance in this rides that very fine line, again, between like a realism within the universe of the film and yet the need to occasionally give him a line where he's going to have a comedy line, like bitches, man, or things like that. And yet it still feels like, in the same way I say how I respect Shaun of the Dead because it's not like really parodying or making a cartoon of it, I still feel they managed to retain that in this.
Bonies chased me out. Came to find you. Where is she?
Went home.
You okay?
No.
Bitches, man.
I would love to see all of the outtakes and alternate takes of him describing to R what it was that he was dreaming about, because Lord knows there are other takes of that where he's like, I saw pictures in my head of a girl, cream of wheat.
Right.
And it's just like, what? How many different versions of that dream were there? Because, I mean, cream of wheat with the pauses, it gets me every single time that he does it. It's sort of like they have a lot of outtakes from the first Shrek movie that they did, where Donkey's like piling into the house and he's describing all the things that they're going to do. And the line they went with in the movie is, you know, in the morning, make waffles. That's the one they go with. But they have all these outtakes of all the other things. He said he tried all the other breakfast foods in that line.
But waffles is funny.
He tried all the other like board games that they might play. It's sort of like they narrowed it in on what's funny. So I want to know how they ended up at Cream of Wheat.
Cream of Wheat.
Because it is the key to my heart.
I wanted to go back to talk about Nicholas Holt's performance, like the zombie character he creates. First of all, what's interesting about this too is apart from the fact that you have to believe within the reality of this film that a dead reanimated corpse could also, by virtue of whatever it is that's reanimated them, which they also are very clear on not being clear on. I like that they make it clear that there's no answer. They don't know how it happened, or at least R doesn't, and therefore we never find out.
Because he's our point of view character.
Yeah. But we have to believe that whatever it was that reanimated them, I mean, basically, I'll suggest this. Basically, we have to believe that whatever reanimated them into a zombie actually has technically resurrected them, and the emotional context of love or whatever it is that feeds the body and the soul, if you want to call it that, takes them the final step toward actual humanity.
Like, biologically, they were resurrected. They just weren't human.
Yes, exactly. And they're like caught in like a limbo state is what the zombie was.
They're like suspended animation. They can move.
Yeah. And the thing is, though, otherwise, their behavior suggests they're very Romero-like in most respects. They shamble. They do move faster when they're near prey. But I like that they establish a lot of things, like they move in packs and they make that into something funny. The idea that they can speak is interesting. They do a beautiful job throughout the movie of slowly building upon that, that as they're starting to regain aspects of their humanity and their memory and their sense of feeling, these things awaken. In fact, now that I think of it, another thing that I used to talk about on the show as being a thing that if you've never seen it, any zombie fan owes it to themselves to see, even though I also always warn you that it ends on a cliffhanger that so far to date has never been resolved and may never be, is the British show In the Flesh. And in that, they also have a storyline where they start to feel again and start to, and like he was feeling like, you know, am I getting cold? Like he's retaining that. And the dream, the idea of like they're getting dreams back, their cognitive functions are returning, but a lot of their zombie behavior is what we'd expect. They eat people.
They hunt by smell.
He disguises Julie on occasion by like putting some of blood or whatever on her.
He romantically smears his rotting blood on her face from a wound that she inflicted upon him with a knife.
And I'd also point out that like minutes after I voiced it, the movie actually addressed the fact that he doesn't smell. Like, they're noticing that he's not smelling that rotten anymore, and that's probably changed.
And that's, to me, it was a hallmark of how well this film was made, because that wasn't the only thing. It's like, there were several points throughout the movie where out loud you were saying, but what about, how come he, and then within, like, 5 minutes of every question you asked, they answered your question
right
in the movie.
And I keep going back to this and forgetting to finish my point. But the thing about Holt's performance, there are elements of it that clearly are inspired by, and then I later found out this is actually true, inspired by Johnny Depp as Edward Scissorhands. That's very clearly there. Even some of the makeup design seems inspired by it, because they even did the thing of like having some scarring on them that's similar to Edward Scissorhands. But there's a weird few moments where Holt does surprised expressions, where he'll like raise an eyebrow. And I don't know if he did that deliberately, because it would be an odd thing to refer back to unless it's just something he knows of and loved. But at times he is identical looking to Ted Cassidy's Lurch in the Addams Family TV show. And there are a couple shots where he gets this look that looks exactly like it. And if he didn't see the Addams Family show, then it's just an amazing coincidence that he recaptures something of that look.
And I will say, in a sense, actually, something that sort of connects these two films together is this idea that the ability to speak is what defines us as human. That in the beginning of Dawn of the Dead, when he's trying to figure out, is she a zombie that has been reanimated, or did she just crash her car and she's a human?
Mm-hmm.
What he says to her is, say something. And it's the same thing here. It's like, in the beginning, all he can kind of do is grunt at his zombie friend. And then he's slowly developing the ability to speak, that it's the words and the communication.
I also think he did an extraordinary job of making the speaking sound like it takes a lot of effort. I mean,
like he's relearning how to do it.
The struggle. And you as the audience have to work to listen to him mm-hmm. at times. And there's so many notes I took on this movie and things I loved about it, like the recurring use of music throughout the film, where R uses music not only as a way of expressing himself, but communicating. Early on, virtually every song he plays has a reference to missing you. And then at one point, he plays her the song, The Shelter from the Storm. He plays her the song of what he's trying to say to her, that he will take care of her and protect her.
Until he can relearn how to speak, he's using music.
Yeah, and he uses records, because as he points out, and I love this, vinyl sounds more alive, which is great, because he's right. But that's also the hipster's response to anybody who's like, well, why don't you use digital music? Because vinyl sounds more organic.
It also, it reminds me a little bit of a scene from The Virgin Suicides, which is also in the book as well, which if you haven't read it or seen it, it's not horror, but it's something right on the edge of it.
Definitely, yeah.
And it's absolutely worth a watch. But the essential element is that there's a group of boys who's trying to talk to the house full of sisters, and they don't know what to say or how to say it. So they call, and when the girls answer the phone, they play a record into the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And then the girls find a record and play a record back to them. Mm-hmm. And then they have a conversation, a complete conversation, never speaking a word to each other. They mm-hmm. just play the song that's saying the thing they want to say.
Very nice, yeah.
And this sort of reminds me a little bit of that concept, because to him, it's not that he doesn't know how to say it. He physically just can't.
Now, you mentioned Pride and Prejudice before, and there's a lot of other stuff that I noted. There's a lot of, and I think we've talked about this before too, when World War Z, the film, may have come up before, maybe I've done this in classes, about how, regardless of how terrible that movie is,
it's terrible. Let's just establish, though, yes, that it's terrible.
But it's very biblical. There's a lot of biblical imagery in that movie. And there's also a lot of biblical imagery in this movie. And one of the things that struck me, too, is that it is a story of resurrection. And yeah, to a certain extent, R is kind of like a messianic Christ figure. He's bringing the message of, you know, the new way. And there's aspects of that. But what really struck me were things like the wall comes tumbling down at the end. So there's the Jericho thing a little bit. I also like the fact, by the way, that John Malkovich's character, I love the fact that this movie takes certain tropes and then we just talking about Z Nation subverting one, subverts them by not playing into the tired cliches that you come to expect. Malkovich's character is sort of the main monster of the film, the military guy who demonizes all the zombies as unfeeling and uncaring, and who's built the wall. And of course, as we well know, it is longstanding in human history how easy it is for us to hurt or kill other human beings simply by demonizing them and turning them into, you know, less than human. And that's what's happening with the zombies here, who are capable of becoming human again. But when he is presented with the facts, he stands down. And in most other movies, I would have expected him to still try to kill R, and he doesn't. He gives up. I mean, not gives up, but he accepts the reality of what's happening. In the same way, when the big battle starts happening at the end, the soldiers are confronted with the humanized zombies fighting the bonies, the ones who have gone too far, and basically they are the true monsters of the film, just utterly inhuman.
And incapable of hope.
Or communication. And when the soldiers see that, they don't even question it. Now, when they question it, but they realize whose side they're on, and they join up with the human zombies. And I love the fact that they do that.
I will say this about John Malkovich's character, Colonel Grigio, who's Julie's father, naturally.
Yeah, right.
He, if given the opportunity the first time that he met R, he would have just shot him in the face.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was this, even being presented with him speaking and walking and not eating people, he would have shot him in the face. It was the second time when he was really presented with sort of empirical evidence that they weren't just changing, but becoming human again. That's what changed his mind. And there's something very specific that I always zero in on when he's talking to his daughter the first time about, no, this is what happens. You get bitten. You come back and you have to be shot in the head. Happens to everyone who gets bitten. It happened to your mother. And obviously, he, to a certain extent, doesn't want to believe that the zombies are capable of changing back into human, because that means that by putting down his wife the moment that she turned, he robbed her of the chance to come back again.
Absolutely.
And I think that in particular is the thing that continues to eat at him.
Ha. Very nice.
Eat it. I did not do that on purpose.
It's also interesting, too, because they don't really play that beat at all at the end of the movie, but that's going to be with him for the rest of his life.
Absolutely.
Knowing that that could have happened. And it also adds a different note to any zombie story. Like we recently talked about Lucy detecting personality in zombies in Z Nation, that as soon as you create a zombie where there's some vestige in there, you have to then question the morality of killing them.
And if she knows that the zombies remember their names, which is also a common thread here, that fixating on trying to remember his name is really important to him.
And I was talking about the biblical thing. So the thing that really struck me, and I mentioned Pride and Prejudice and the biblical thing, is I knew there had to be a moment where he goes to dives in something and gets wet, because I thought that's got to happen.
You even did ask me that when we were watching.
Yeah, I knew that had to happen. But what really got me was it happens at the end. He dives in with her, and it's when he dives in with her, there's that beautifully, it's just artful stuff. He's been slowly turning flesh color through the movie as he's been getting more and more, you know, real, more like a real boy. That's another thing, by the way, warm bodies, Pinocchio. It's just a version of Pinocchio, but we don't have time for everything. So put a pin in Pinocchio.
It's every fairy tale all wrapped up into one with zombies.
It is. And then, but then what I love is he's been getting more flesh colored, and then they dive in. She thinks he might be dead. And the shot of him under the water shows him at his whitest and bluest because it's under the water. But then when he comes out of the water, he looks completely flesh colored. It is a moment of baptism and resurrection and purification. It is a purely biblical, symbolic moment where all of it is washed away and he comes out reborn.
And then he opens his Nicholas Holt eyes.
They are stunning. And there's so much else in this. It's not a mall, but an airport. And I love the fact that the place they go is a place where people go to connect from one thing to another.
It's where you are when you're in transition.
Yeah, and it's beautiful stuff. And I like the Joss Whedon slow walk when all the zombies start walking in a row and they're going to go. I think it's like there's an inspirational moment that's genuinely moving, where we have this sort of almost Tolkien-esque War of the Three Armies at the end, where it's the human soldiers, the zombies, and the bonies. And you know that everybody on the good side are going to team up.
And Rob Corddry gets an amazing line where the soldiers are sort of saying, like, who do we shoot? And Rob Corddry throws a skeleton at them and says, this asshole.
And that's right. About the bonies. Ponies. They are basically the furthest gone version of a traditional zombie, although very fast. But I did note at one point, they're angry. They're also motivated by emotion. It's almost like their reaction to what's happening is that they feel betrayed by the more human zombies. They're mad at them. It's much more fury than just, oh, we found more prey. They're really angry.
Which is an absolutely beautiful metaphor for people, how people react when they have no hope left. That a lot of people, to them, when they just can't see a way through things, they react with anger. They lash out. And that's what these bonies are doing. Not only that, but they quite literally do it to themselves. It shows the transition from zombie to bony, which involves basically just caring so little about anything anymore that they're willing to just peel off all of their own flesh and reduce themselves down to a skeleton, because what does it even matter?
Which also sounds like that could be like a commentary on people that hurt themselves, you know, or cut.
There's a lot of metaphor you could pull out of this.
A lot of great modern usage of the zombie concept and warm bodies to comment on our current society, which is exactly the best of what the genre has. I just want to mention a couple other things. We seem to be on a Nightmare City kick for some weeks now, and there's a moment where R wipes his mouth, and we talked about how polite the Nightmare City zombies were wiping their mouths, is that he actually mentions that eating the brains gives them memories and thoughts and feelings, and he derives some of Julie's boyfriend's life from that, which is very much what iZombie wound up doing and had done in the comic before the TV show. And I then also like the fact that at one point he tells her, in order to get through the runway, to act dead, which is very much a play on the same thing that Shaun and everybody do in Shaun of the Dead. But I love the fact that this movie takes it a step further very cleverly and then has a scene that bookends that, where Julie had to act dead like a zombie. R then has to try to walk like a human and go into the human compound and convince them he's alive, which is a beautiful twist on what is otherwise another common zombie cliche of trying to blend in with the zombies. And then it ends with that line, "This is how the world was exhumed." And it gave me a warm feeling. It just is a moving piece, and it kind of makes you feel like, wouldn't it be nice if more people actually learned this lesson, particularly now? But I think it's absolutely excellent. So once again, another movie we've seen recently that I think is just an absolutely stunning use of the genre.
Absolutely. And I'd say if you were holding off on seeing it because you're thinking, this was a YA book, I'm not sure, I don't know that I don't want to watch a romance or something like that, it fits into none of those molds, really. It has its own sort of formulaic way of going through the plot, but it just does it in such a refreshing way that it's absolutely worth your time.
And that'll do it for this episode of Doctor of the Dead. Find a complete archive of this show, along with many other podcasts, at itunes.com/G2V. Be sure to subscribe for the latest episodes, and if you like what you hear, rate and review. On Twitter, follow Arnold at Doctor of the Dead and Natalie at NB Latowski. Doctor of the Dead is a G2V and ATV Publishing production.